Welcome to the First Unitarian Universalist Society of New Haven, a home for liberal religion since 1836. We take an open and free approach to religion, while at the same time retaining healthy respect for those traditions that have shaped us in so many ways. Our service this morning has a theme of longing for connection. So it's a little different. We're using some Elvis Presley songs and ask you to understand that the service may, in a sense, be kind of like a collage where you are asked to assemble the pieces yourself into a totality. And I'll do it a little bit in the talk, but I'm encouraging you to use your own imagination and your own feelings to try to do that. So let's now greet our neighbors. Why don't we go ahead with the chalice lighting, which I asked Dave to do with Dave.
We can never be grateful enough to the earth, which has given us everything. Coming home to her, we come home to ourselves.
Okay, well, I have a poem that I wrote more than 20 years ago, and so you'll be able to see how insistent the muse is in keeping on driving home the same point over and over. It's called After a Poem of Rilke, just because it quotes a couple of lines from a poem from a German poet, Rilke. Ruthlessly torn from the mother's body, chipped out with picks and shovels, blasted with dynamite, chewed away by immense steel teeth, the ore flows to the mills and the furnaces, at first on the backs of conscripted peasants and mules, later on broad conveyor belts and in railroad cars. The ore is crushed. The metal driven from it by intense heat pours into molds, assumes the alien form of the molds. The metal, so separated and refined, moves out from the smelting places to factories and workshops, where human beings, made unnaturally rational by injections of knowledge, shape it into useful objects, or any objects that will sell. People buy it, use it, hoard it, lose it, throw it away. The metal is filled with yearning. Derelict cars in the dooryards of Maine, abandoned railroad tracks, children's toys, wrenches lost and rusting in the grass, battleships lying in the canyons of the sea, stir restlessly. They long to be home again, deep in the living rock. The great steel girders that hold up Manhattan, bright new fuel-efficient cars just off the ship from Japan, copper-bottomed kettles on the shelves of hardware stores, bomb casings and the hulls of rockets, ingots of gold in Fort Knox. They, too, feel the magnetism. All the metal in the world wants to go back into the veins of the thrown open mountain, which will close again behind it. All the metal in the world dreams. Deep in the mother's body, it will absorb energy. Transfused with the plasma of the mother, it will glow with the ardor of its own original being. Pulses of light rhythmically shake the whole interior of the mother's body. I have asked Teresa to read a poem by Sharon Dubiago called Crazy Horse. This is a poem that falls about halfway through her long epic, basically, about the United States called Hard Country, which she wrote in the 70s, specifically in response to the great kind of epic poems by Ezra Pound and William Carlos Williams and others. to give a woman's point of view, which she thought was somewhat missing. Now, just a little background before we hear the poem. Crazy Horse went out on a vision quest as a young man, and he fell into a trance, and he heard a little hawk crying over his head, and he was told that he would be a great warrior, and that he should wear into battle only a little painted lightning on his cheeks and some hail spots on his body, and put a little brown stone behind his ear, and other than that, wear a loincloth, and if he did that, he would never be injured. And in fact, many people on both sides saw him ride into battle under withering bullet fire, and he was evidently never hit. Sometimes his horse was shot out from under him, and someone came in and rescued him. And then finally, he was also told that as long as that the only condition in which he could be killed would be if people of his own tribe were to hold his arms down at his side. And there's reference to this in the poem also.
Crazy Horse. I dream he is my lover. We lie on the hard ground beneath a single robe, the marriage blanket. We lie against an old wooden fort on the dark prairie. Inside, men drink as in a lighted bar. Across the black night, I feel the others pressing in on us. Against the black night, I feel him beside me, hard and lean. Then I feel him out there, coming naked on his horse. In my oldest dream on earth, I am shooting and shooting. The small revolver blooms into red, hot, and yellow flames that disappear from me across the ravished nightland. When he is beside me, dark and lean, he shows me how to shoot to save his life. There are times when I am alone and know he is trying to come to me out of the black night. I hold off the others who crawl across the field to kill us. One, he is not like any man I have known. He takes me all the way into the male world. There is no separation as with other men and women. Our survival depends on each other. We are deep sexual mates in the physical eternity. He is the one I have waited for, my strange, familiar Obama. Two, I am shooting into the night as they crawl across the field to kill us. I see him among the rifles. When the black fog lifts, I see him afoot, surrounded. I pull him on the back of my horse and zigzag back through the soldiers, the burning red bullets. One. Beneath the black marriage shawl, our clear bodies lie naked on the ground. We are invisible. I braid grass stems into his light hair. There are streakings all about us, arrows and lead balls, but they disappear before hitting us. The danger is great only if we fail each other. Through the whole night, a chorus of wolves resounds from the frozen mountains around us. Beneath our massive robe, we lie in the deep ease of each other's body, the dark and the dark ground. Two, on the holy road, he has left sticks pointing in the direction he has gone. There, I find him on the ridge above the dwindling buffalo herd, his gun silent across his knees, watching, as if he is herding his cattle. When he sees me coming up the long hill, our eyes lock. Behind him, the storm clouds of night rolls, and thunder stirs the hair about his waist. He starts towards me well forward on his horse, whose neck is high, whose feet move freely. I see the splattering of hail spots on his naked body that makes him invisible to others. Only the hair about his waist and the heel fringes of his moccasins stir as he rides to me. He takes the rope of the horse from my hand and swings his blanket about me, holding me in its folds. He presses the wet, zigzag lightning in his face against my cheek. I put my hand beneath his large testicles. I hold him. We lean against the hard, lean night. The enemy shadows all around us. He is the first man who lets me love him as deeply as I know. We lie on our sides, facing each other beneath the heavy black shawl. In this way, we join our bodies. There is no separation. With my free hand, I play with a small brown stone behind his ear. He lies in me long, searching quietly, as with a free hand, a deep and great place. I stir on him slowly, rising upwards as through a flood. He becomes a part of what there is, a hard gold death. Behind his face, the small red hawk flies, making his killy killy cry. Without quickening his pace, moving deeply, deliberately, he listens. He waits as I come to save his life. Only I can take this death from him, this violet dark sun who has been killed and shines no more. My crazy Oglala, my strange animal. 2. He comes out of the dark purple night, naked on his horse, but for the splattering of painted hailstones, the lightning streaked down his face. As he comes, he fires the prairie, burning the grass the soldiers' horses need to live, filling every clear day with a great rolling of clouds of smoke, the sun blood red, the night sky shining as from northern lights. I will grieve through 7 generations for this sexual lover, this sleeper on the ground. The night earth beneath me is his body. I cannot answer all the bright heat of the sun, most men with their inward leaves. He is the strange, heavy man who goes with me. When we lie together on the ground, I am careful not to hold his arms in.
A man named Paul Shepherd was the first person to hold a professorship in the field of human ecology. This was back in the 1970s out in California. Previously, one studied ecology. The human was the observer, the separate knower of food chains and webs of connection. And Shepherd asked, how do humans fit in? How are they apart? I'm not saying nobody else had ever thought of this before, but he was the first one that actually had a professorship in this field. He wrote a book called Nature and Madness in the 70s. And in that book, he takes one conceptual map and lays it over another one. He starts out with everything that is known about, or he summarizes what is known about hunter-gatherer societies, mostly from the work of people who lived with people living the old way back in the 1920s and 30s. Where they really, had a pretty concrete ability to understand how they actually functioned. And then he took the field of developmental psychology, and he summarizes that, and he lays these over each other. And he asks the question, okay, how did development go in that earlier society as compared to how it goes in our society? And you remember Freud's description. Shepherd tends to talk more about boys, possibly because that's what the psychologist did. That might be a little bias of his own. He's interested in hunting. But in any case, supposedly, according to Freud, the boy wants to get rid of his father and marry his mother. And then he goes into a latency period, and then at puberty comes this crisis where, in order to become a man, he has to begin to transfer his affections to another woman who would be a substitute for his mother, and I think that creates certain problems. And so the thing that's interesting in what Shepherd does is he says, during this latency period, and this would be true of the girls as well as the boys, the children are all out in the field. They are spending a lot of time learning the plants and the animals and how the land lies, basically, because they live in a region. And it's said that hunter-gatherer people generally can identify about 250 kinds of plants. They know which ones you can eat, when they come around during the year, which ones are poisonous, which ones are medicinal. And so he imagines that the boys, particularly, would be like boys we know who are fascinated with model airplanes and little cars and all kinds of things like this. And they would just be fascinated in a kind of almost abstract way with this taxonomy, with this whole ordering of the world. And then comes this emotional crisis, unexpected, and they are then initiated into manhood, and they're taught some of the traditions and so on. And basically, according to Shepherd, what happens is they transfer the affections and the loyalty and the sense of dependence that they had in relation to their mothers to that terrain, which is, in fact, the source of the life of their own tribe. So Whereas in our society, there's the transference to another woman, and we might also say, I believe, a transference to the economy, a transference to the state. If you go back to the ancient Near East, you transfer to the god king of, you know, Pharaoh in Egypt or the god kings of Mesopotamia. Everything's at the top of the pyramid. And so the ultimate source of your life is at the top. Completely different in this situation. These commitments and feelings are expressed through participation in this complex, many-dimensional life place where one is living. So the land itself is a place of flowing life, and there is a constant interchange of feeling and energy between the human and the land. So what is at stake here is a deep commitment to the actual sources of our lives. This is not about the flight of the alone to the alone or to the other who is elsewhere. Rather, there's the sense that the source is imminent, present. It's here under our feet and around us and in us. And I believe this is what we need to rediscover today. Now, this is not quite the same as what the Romantics talked about, because they had a kind of a global sense of this whole thing, you know, the wonderful infinite within the finite. You know, I mean, I resonate to that, but what this is about is much more concrete. It's an escape, not an escape from reality, as people imply when they use the word romantic as a kind of a swear word, but rather it is an escape to reality. For hundreds of generations, we lived in community. We were connected in large extended families, clans, tribes, and our human communities were grounded into the community of living beings. We were enmeshed and enfolded in the living earth in our various places. Now we have lost this intimacy of connection. We have lost community. And it is doubtful, I believe, whether we can survive as a species unless we regain community, unless we know commonwealth again, unless we realize that we can be ourselves only in relation to everything else. All our relations doesn't mean nostalgia for the Indian way so much as it means reweaving the web of life beginning from where we are. I think that's the hard part, that we can't really see how to get there from here. But reweaving the web of life is a project of several generations. And it's not, it may appear to be grandiose. It may seem, well, this is too huge. We can't take it on. But we don't have a blueprint. We have something more like an algorithm. In other words, we have a way that we can add by accretion a little bit and a little bit and a little bit and. So that we form new connections, new relationships. And I think that we live in a time, you know, you go back to the, like 50 years ago, existentialism, the sense of alienation that was so profound and which has continued in other ways. We have a longing for connection. I think we have been failing now for a long time. And as we come to accept this reality that we have been failing, a new possibility opens up. Instead of flying up to heaven, we go down. Instead of the mad pursuit of a wonder world that never comes, we may enter into horizontal or lateral connections. So you can move through failure, through sadness, as we heard a little bit in the music earlier. That's a song, music, by the way, from a movie that had to do with how the Greeks were forced out of Asia Minor from, or, you know, Turkey in the early 20th century, in the area, you know, Smyrna especially. And they were forced to go and live in Greece, where they really weren't very welcome because they were, you know, like foreigners almost. And so there's this terrible sadness of being refugees that has been such a common experience in the 20th century. And in a way, we're refugees from the earth. So as we experience this grief and failure, we can move into a deeper consciousness and find around us that there are depths which will support and carry us. We're already connected through our bodily life, through the actual interchanges of energy and food and water and air. We're already connected. We're already living inside the sacred body of the goddess. We can't get any more intimate with her than we already are. But we may be unaware of this. We may be mentally detached. So we're already home. The solution is to reach out and touch, know who you already are, awaken. And this is a poem that's not too old that I wrote called That Which Flows Sent Me. There's an intention of a reference to Moishe here. Anybody remember about Moishe? Moishe was out in the land of Midian tending sheep, and when he was about 40, he murdered a guy down in Egypt, and he got in a big jam, so he went up to the land of Midian, and he got married up there, and he was now about 80, and he figured, well, he was set. He was going to keep on tending the sheep out there. And then he had this bizarre experience where he sees that there's a bush burning. Well, of course, if you're out in the wilderness somewhere, usually you wouldn't see just one bush burning, but that's what it was. And then it got even stranger because the bush didn't burn up. And so he went over there to see what was what, and he heard this voice say, take your shoes off because you're on holy ground, which he did. And then the voice said, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and I've got a little job for you. And he said, well, you know, really, I'm pretty much content here. I am 80, and I don't think I'm really up for it. And the Lord said, no, I think, you know, you're the man. And what I want you to do is I see the oppression of my people down in Egypt, and Pharaoh is grinding their faces in the dirt, and I want you to go down there in front of Pharaoh and say, let my people go. And Moses said, yeah, but the thing is, you know, they don't know from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob down there anymore. And I'm going to say to the Lord, they won't know what that is. So who shall I say sent me? And the Lord says, say, I am sent me. And later on, that was picked up by Thomas Aquinas. And the idea in Christian theology was God is pure being, which tended to be something rather static and rather distant, right? Even though that's not really quite what the Old Testament God is like. Okay, so I wrote this poem in which I wasn't sent by I am, I was sent by that which flows. Empire is about dams, about blocking, impounding, diverting, and redirecting flows of water, of energy, of raw materials, of thought, of desire, of feeling. Empire is about controlling and harnessing the flowing life of the world. It is about making money flow uphill through the deployment of skillful, cunning, devious means. All roads must converge in Grand Central Station. All cars must run on rigid rails laid down in perfect order in this best of all possible worlds, this empire of manufactured objects. But all that which flows has a will and a mind of its own. All that which flows is alive with power from within itself. Empire is obliged to beg, borrow, or steal its power from the only source there is, namely, that which flows. That which flows is alive with its own life. It borrows not, begs not, steals not. Alive with its own life, its own juice, it flows on. If it encounters a block, it simply builds up until it overcomes the barrier. All blocks and dams are temporary. That which flows outlasts them all. Empires collapse. That which flows will never cease. You can poison the sexuality of the masses with guilt and shame, but you cannot shut it down. You can ban the use of drums, but the slaves will beat out rhythms on their own bodies. They will create work songs which provide new channels for the driving power of the drum, the same complex rhythms as before. They will innocently sing these rhythmic songs in the very teeth of the overseers. The empire of mass consumption skillfully, craftily dams, impounds, diverts, and controls that which flows in us. The energies of life, the desires of this body, it tames and disciplines, causing them to flow into the malls, into the cars, into the clothes and makeup, into the entertainment carefully designed to serve the purposes of the masters. The flows of thought and feeling, the blood which is our life, they seduce to flow through the turbines of corporate power. Private syndicates generate enormous profits from a system of locks and dams and canals of feeling, a system of pipes and valves so complicated that we don't even know what is happening to us. We are led to the slaughter by our own desire. But I tell you now, understand this, a change is coming. The empire is in big trouble. The flow of oil from impoverished desert kingdoms begins to fail. Those at the top can scarcely conceal their panic. Arrogant braggadocio reveals desperation, not strength. 25 empires known to history have collapsed due to ecological overdrafts. The present and first ever worldwide empire will soon follow suit. All human beings everywhere will suffer the effects of this disaster. That which flows will not miss a beat. This is the moment of dangerous opportunity, a chance for real adventures and novel experiments. That which flows will break through the dikes. Valves of the heart, long closed up like stone, will open. The water of life will seek new paths out of its own surpassing abundance. People will open up new channels of two-way communication. They will establish new connections. Romeo will marry Juliet against imperial law and custom. In the absence of TV sedatives, human beings will invent new pleasures, dance new dances, open up new territories. That which flows makes no distinction between the festival of death and the festival of life. The corpses of a defeated army are the feast of crows, vultures, and coyotes. Desire makes its own way in the world. New life wells up from deep underground in the craters of catastrophe. As the soft flowing water of the great river creates the Grand Canyon, so that which flows erodes the powers of the powers that be, opens up new channels and creates fantastic forms, stunning works of art out of the ruins of thrones and dominions. Here then is what you must do. Unplug from established channels. Make new connections. Haste forbidden pleasures. Make of your life an adventure, a series of experiments. Dare to explore those possibilities formerly blanked out by the wizard's grandiose spectacle. Court new experiences. Reach out and touch those persons formerly forbidden to you. Dive deep into the flowing rivers of the earth. Abandon yourself to the dance. Commune utterly with that which flows. Invent new forms of life. Do not wait for instructions from those higher up. You are the ones, the people we've all been waiting for, strong enough to love this fate prepared for you by the chances of time. Without resentment or remorse, give yourselves up to the secret currents of irresistible life. And now we may have a postlude.